The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're going to start in the work and money section. The article is 88-year-old divorce lawyer Harriet Cohen calls retirement the enemy. Oprah has said, "When you know who you are and what you stand for, you stand in wisdom." It's in this vein that Oprah Daily presents the Wisdom Corner, a space for women who are leaders in their communities, from Grammy-winning entertainers to accomplished lawyers, to share their hard-earned life lessons. As they reflect on the gifts time and experience has given them, we hope you'll take a moment to absorb their musings in this small but wise corner of the Internet. Divorce lawyer Harriet Newman Cohen has started what she calls her third life, and it all began with a brand new law firm, Cohen Stein Kapoor LLP, which she opened on New Year's Day of 2021, alongside her daughter Martha Cohen Stein and founding partner Annette Kapoor. For Cohen, the pandemic, which saw a rapid increase in divorce throughout the earliest months of 2020, provided yet another opportunity for reinvention, a reoccurring theme throughout her life. Like many of us, Cohen and the rest of her team worked remotely for much of last year, but now she's fully vaccinated and moved into her new office in Times Square. When the pandemic hit and brick and mortar seemed to be an enemy and people were thinking about what's the new world going to look like, I took that opportunity to recreate my firm and myself, she tells Oprah Daily. I immediately learned all of the technology that I needed to. I taught myself how to host meetings on video, how to have breakout rooms, and intake for my clients on Zoom. It's revolutionized the world. At 2 years shy of 90, the same energy that inspired her to found a new law office in a world altered by COVID-19 goes back to what the attorney dubbed her second life. Fresh off of her own divorce at age 38, she decided to attend law school as a single mother of four. Cohen is now one of the most respected matrimonial and family lawyers in New York. She was president of the New York Women's Bar Association and is regularly named to the state's annual top lawyers lists. The New York Times cites her expertise, and her high-profile cases include representing Lawrence Fishburne, Andrew Cuomo, Paul George, and Eve Chilton, Harvey Weinstein's first wife, in their respective divorces. As the years have passed, she'd earned a reputation through a 40-plus year career that she is nowhere near ready to give up. When I would walk into a room, there would be a hush, she says. Harriet has arrived. Then as I got a little older, I became Amazing Harriet. Rather than being the unwanted person in the room, you know, the old lady, it was, when is Harriet going to arrive? We welcomed Cohen to the Wisdom Corner to learn how her ambition and passion for her work has carried through life and the pandemic. What was it like entertaining law school in your late 30s? In those days, women were supposed to be highly educated, be at home and raise very educated children, and feel completely fulfilled through their husbands and their children. So I got a great education at Barnard College and a master's at Bryn Mawr College. I had four daughters right away within the first 10 years of my graduation. Then I realized that that wasn't going to be enough for me. In 1971, 18 years later, after Barnard, I entered law school because I felt I wanted to be able to have my own life when my children left the nest. I did very, very well. It was unusual for a person of my age to go to law school, but I think there's a lot more of that today. I was with people who graduated when they were 24, and I was 41. I seem very old, but when I look back now, I was so young. How do you feel about retiring? Retirement for me would be an enemy because I have so much to offer. There was a theme in this country that people age 65, certainly by 75, would retire. They would live on their savings and do, I don't know, RV travel around the country? None of that ever was of interest to me. What was of interest to me was that every single day I was meeting new people. I have a huge client base, the judges and the other lawyers. The judges in the New York state system are required to retire at age 70. age 70 these days is truly the new 50. In the United States Supreme Court, they can sit there until they're 110. There's no age that they have to retire by. I measure myself and I analogize myself of what I do to what they do. The reason that some of these older justices are so desirable is they know so much. They've come through so much. They're so dimensional, and the ones that they make retire in the state system, you're losing people with so much experience. As a divorce lawyer for over 40 years, what is it like to see so many couples break up? The field of divorce is not what it was years ago. It's not sending a detective to a hotel to see whether there's adultery being committed. It's partnership law, honestly. For me, it's a very liberating thing. People after divorce, for the most part, are happier than before, because nobody should live with someone who doesn't want to live with them, or who's betraying them, or who's hurting them. Children shouldn't live in a war zone. So I see my job as taking people to a better place by helping them understand that they don't want to be where they are now. They have to move on, or they have to grow. We've seen change in how celebrities approach divorce, like Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin's famous conscious uncoupling. It's evolving. We do have a little more parity, shall we say, in terms of the earnings. We have a lot more co-parenting than when I started. The 50s father came home at the end of a long day of work, was served. Somebody put his slippers on for him, gave him his pipe. The kids were supposed to be seen but not heard. That's not how your fathers are today. I don't think we change all that much. I think we take ourselves with us. I see fathers who are just like mothers, and mothers who are just like fathers, which changes the divorce. We're in a whole different world, which is exciting for me as an older person because I've lived through different regimes in my field. What have you learned about yourself since you began your career? I'm the same person I was at age 6. When I was a little girl in Providence, Rhode Island, there was a hurricane. I recall my mother saying to me, "You have the choice, Harriet. You can stay home or you can go to school." I said, "I want to go to school." The teacher and I were there alone. I was in a kindergarten, and I'll never forget that day as long as I live. It was wonderful. I remember she was teaching me cursive penmanship at the time. I was a very hard worker then, and I'm a very, very hard worker now. I don't think we change all that much. I think we take ourselves with us. How would you define wisdom? Wisdom is a combination of experience, knowledge, applying research, being very honest about what you don't know, being willing to ask questions, but open-mindedness and the ability to listen. Oh my God, that's the most important thing of all, is to listen really hard to what another person is saying to you. Do you believe you're wise? I think I'm wise, but I think I have a lot to learn. I know what I don't know, and I don't know so much. I would not shoot from the hip. What I've learned about myself is that I was very blessed, with enormously good education, very good health, a very good attitude, and the ability to absorb and to internalize everything that I learned so that when it came time to start the third life of Harriet Cohen, not at age 41, but at age 88, I was ready for it. Another article from Work and Money. The stars of Nat Geo's Critter Fixers want to inspire the next generation of black veterinarians. 4 minutes before sitting down to speak to Oprah Daily, Dr. Vernard Hodges finished up a risky procedure to remove a tumor on an 11-year-old cat's tongue. "You're darned if you do, darned if you don't. If you don't do it, the cat dies. If you do do it, the cat still has a strong chance of dying," Dr. Hodges says. It was only the fifth or sixth time in his 2 decades as a practicing vet that Dr. Hodges had to perform tongue surgery, and the experience wasn't entirely pleasant. "Tongues bleed a lot. There's not a lot you can do since you can't close it," Dr. Terrence Ferguson, Dr. Hodges' partner at their veterinary hospital in Bonaire, Georgia, located 100 miles south of Atlanta, explains. Fortunately, the cat pulled through, and before the cat, the veterinarians helped a baby duckling and a bearded dragon. "The day is still going. That's half a day. Soon as you think you have it figured out, 3 emergencies walk in the door," Dr. Ferguson says. The Nat Geo Wild Show Critter Fixers Country Vets captures the vet's hectic schedule and the joy they derive from it. "This is definitely my dream job," Dr. Hodges says. Dr. Ferguson says on his end that he couldn't imagine doing anything else. The doctors met and became friends as undergraduates at Georgia's Fort Valley State University. At the time, Dr. Hodges was passionate about marine biology and wanted to become the first black Jacques Cousteau. "I thought I'd be making maiden voyages in the deepest, darkest depths of the sea," he says, but he soon realized his love for animals extended beyond aquatic life. Dr. Ferguson, on the other hand, wanted to become a vet since he was 8. His interest was sparked by caring for his family dog after it had an accident. That lit a fire in me and my heart. I wanted to be an animal doctor at that point. I thought it was a dog doctor. My mom said, "No, baby, it's called a veterinarian." My mom's an educator, so she didn't miss that opportunity to teach me to spell that word. While he was encouraged by family and friends, Dr. Ferguson wasn't confident that becoming a vet was possible. According to a 2019 study, fewer than 1% of the 104,000 veterinarians in the U.S. are black, falling from 2.1% in a 2016 study per Time. Dr. Ferguson considered studying fisheries and wildlife because he had black peers in that field. It was only until his sophomore year of college that he ever met another black veterinarian, and he changed courses back to his original childhood dream. He encouraged me. "Had I not met that person, I definitely know I would not be sitting here today," Dr. Ferguson says. Both Dr. Ferguson and Dr. Hodges went on to attend Tuskegee University, the only historically black college or university, HBCU, with a veterinary program. Today, Tuskegee University educates about 70% of the country's black veterinarians, though the number was higher when Dr. Ferguson and Dr. Hodges graduated in 1997 and 1998, respectively. Their years at Tuskegee were instrumental for more reasons than learning the ins and outs of the profession. The university instilled in them a sense of confidence. "You went from never seeing black veterinarians to all I see are black veterinarians. They look just like you. They're doing what you want to do. The level of proud is, wow. It's encouraging, wanting to make them proud of you. Representation matters, and it did for us," Dr. Ferguson says. Dr. Hodges and Dr. Ferguson founded Critter Fixers Veterinary Hospital in 1999. When producers first approached them about making a show about their lives decades later, the vets were surprised. "We didn't even know we were funny," Dr. Hodges says. Ultimately, their intention with Critter Fixers was to expose youth to the veterinary profession. By showing a veterinary hospital that features black vets and black vet techs, they can be the visible role models neither of them had growing up. "We hope to use this legacy to create more minority vets and more kids knowing that veterinary medicine is an amazing profession," Dr. Hodges says. And according to feedback from audience members, it's working. "Every day we get a mother or a child who says, 'Thank you so much for encouraging my child. Thank you so much for showing my kid that it's possible,'" Dr. Hodges says. "Thank you so much for showing my kid that it's possible." Among the profession's next generation is Dr. Hodges' own son, who plans to become a vet one day. "We almost convinced Dr. Ferguson's daughter. We're not there yet, but we're close," Dr. Hodges says, laughing. The second season of Critter Fixers wraps up on July 3rd, but it's available to stream on Disney+, and makes for a fantastic family-friendly watch. In the show, the veterinarians treat a turtle with a shell infection, an aggressive camel, a pregnant goat, a mysteriously overweight lizard, a dog with a horn, and more, just a sliver of the 20,000 animals the hospital treats annually. No matter the species, Dr. Ferguson calls the animals babies, and he puts it, "They're members of the family. They can't take care of themselves. They need us." Their practice sees such a vast variety of animals and in such a range of conditions because of its rural location. As Hodges explains, Critter Fixers is approximately 3 hours in every direction from any major veterinary hospital. Whereas humans can see specialists for their specific conditions, Dr. Hodges and Dr. Ferguson are the end of the road. "Everything stops with us," Dr. Hodges says. "If the animal gets hit by a car, I have to stop what I'm doing and go to the emergency room. If it's a puppy stuck in a birth canal, I have to become an obstetrician and do a C-section. And then you have to become a neonatologist to save the puppy. Or if it gets cancer, I have to remove the cancer and do the chemo. If it breaks bones, we have to become orthopedists. Your primary physician can send you to 20 specialists. We have to fix it all," Dr. Hodges says. "It's a mental strain." While the doctors were taught the basics while studying at Tuskegee, one of only 32 veterinary schools in the nation, they did a great deal of learning on the job. In season one of Critter Fixers, for example, Dr. Hodges performed his first ever leg amputation on a chinchilla with a camera crew watching. Off camera, Dr. Hodges and Dr. Ferguson brainstormed the treatment for a rare bird neither had encountered. "There's a certain place we may have to draw the line. tigers, Dr. Ferguson jokes. Despite its challenges, these self-proclaimed country vets would never consider being city vets and having a more central practice. Both grew up in rural Georgia. Dr. Ferguson hails from Talbotton, a town in West Georgia with two traffic lights. Dr. Hodges grew up in a trailer park in Fort Valley. This is who I am. I think if I had to move to a city, I wouldn't fit in very well. We decided that we could make our own way. We didn't have to conform to anything else, Dr. Ferguson says. Part of the veterinary's goal with Critter Fixers is to capture the day-in, day-out, often unglamorous life of a veterinarian. In doing so, they hope to mitigate the common misconceptions of the profession. Namely, it's not always playing with cute animals, though sometimes it is. Dr. Hodges raised a baby duckling to the camera to say hello on our Zoom. The vets encourage local families to drop off their children at Critter Fixers for a day of shadowing. It looks glorified from the outside, puppies all day, but they urinate, they vomit, some are aggressive. I want them to see these things so they're assured that they can handle that too, Dr. Hodges says. As exhilarating and rewarding as their job is, they're constantly confronted by the cycle of life. At one point on Critter Fixers, Dr. Hodges tries and fails to save a newborn puppy. Afterwards, he steps outside to gather himself. Nothing hurts our heart like when they die, Dr. Hodges says. The veterinarians frequently have to euthanize families' beloved animals. After 20 years in practice, these are often animals they first met as puppies and watched grow. On some days, the veterinarians perform this procedure up to 5 times. Each time, it takes a little bit of you away. Just a little bit, Dr. Hodges says. During their job's most gut-wrenching days, as Dr. Ferguson calls them, they rely on each other and their decades-long friendship to preserve their mental health. He understands what I'm going through because he's going through the same thing. I understand what he's going through because I'm going through the same thing. That relationship is definitely beautiful. It's invaluable, Dr. Ferguson says. Hug your pets. Never forget the love they give to us. We want to reciprocate that back to them. But the hardest part of their job has taught them lessons, which is why Critter Fixers often depict sadder moments. Animals, they say, teach us about responsibility and appreciating the time we have together. That time that you have with your pet, you need to cherish it. The time I have with Dr. Hodges, I need to cherish it, Dr. Ferguson says. As for all of you pet parents reading this article, Dr. Hodges and Dr. Ferguson have one more piece of simple, vet-approved advice. Hug your pets. Never forget the love that they give us. We want to reciprocate that back to them. We're moving on to the health and wellness section. Just 10 minutes of working out could save your life. It's easier than you think. You don't need us to tell you that exercise is important. Even still, fitting in a workout can be tough, especially when you take into account the National Physical Activity Guidelines that suggest 2 strength training days and 150 minutes of weekly moderate intensity aerobic activity. So when news of a new study came out that even just 10 minutes of activity a day could literally save your life, we were all ears. Yup, 10 minutes really counts. The research, which was published in JAMA Internal Medicine and included 4,840 adults who exercise regularly as well as those who are more sedentary, estimated that if all adults in the U.S. over age 40 increased their activity by 10 minutes each day, about 110,000 deaths could be prevented each year, explains Pedro Saint-Maurice, Ph.D., lead study author and epidemiologist in the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics at the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. Doing even more, say 20 or 30 minutes of exercise, extended the health benefits. Cutting back on 209,459 and 272,297 preventable deaths, respectively. But the advantages aren't just for the over 40 set. Saint-Maurice says the research projected similar benefits for men and women. Mexican-American, non-Hispanic, black, and non-Hispanic white adults of various ages. Maximize your minutes. Need a little extra motivation to get out there and sweat? Beyond extending your life, it will make you feel a lot better. While this is a little obvious, it's worth a reminder. As we age, we tend to lose muscle. Our hormones start to change. Weight creeps up, even if we aren't careful. Our mobility decreases, and our chances of cognitive decline start to increase, explains Joe Holder, founder of the Ocho System and a Nike master trainer. Literally all of this can be impacted beneficially with exercise. Holder suggests thinking about these little short activity sessions as exercise snacks to make them feel less daunting. And rather than trying to find time, think about things you already do that you can add movement to. For example, maybe you work remotely and have a weekly update call that doesn't require you to be chained to your laptop. Consider popping in earbuds and taking the dog for a walk. Or perhaps you usually sit in the car and listen to a podcast while your kid is at soccer practice. Instead, listen to that podcast while walking around the field. Already nailing a regular workout routine? Holder suggests adding in a couple more steps, making your warm-up a bit longer, or increasing your cardio by a few extra minutes. Or you can focus on more movement outside of your standard gym session, he says. St. Maurice adds that even vigorous household chores and gardening counts. The bottom line, a longer life may be within your reach, but you're going to have to get moving for at least a few minutes a day. Still in health and wellness, this article is, "This therapy you've never heard of could change your life." When a friend told me about a life-changing therapy called DBT, I was intrigued, until she told me that DBT stood for Dialectical Behavior Therapy. It was like a great book with a terrible cover. What was dialectical even mean anyway? Next. But people I knew just kept on talking about DBT. Some were using it to cut down on their drinking or stop yelling at their kids. Others leaned on it during difficult divorces. After half a dozen rave reviews, I decided to stop judging a book by its cover. I asked three leading DBT experts to explain what the therapy is exactly and why everyone is talking about it and how it can help us all lead better lives. The gist. Rock star psychologist Marsha Linehan developed DBT in the late 1970s at the University of Washington to treat severely suicidal and self-injuring patients with borderline personality disorder. These patients needed a way to control the intense emotions driving them to take dangerous actions, and that's what Linehan delivered. By building skills in mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotional regulation, and interpersonal relationships, DBT helps people turn the knob down on emotional reactions so they're not driven to impulsive behaviors, explains Matthew McKay, Ph.D., author of The Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Workbook, Second Edition, and co-director of the Bay Area Trauma Recovery Clinic in San Francisco. DBT is now used to treat a slew of issues, including substance abuse, binge eating, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and complex trauma. Beyond that, therapists are increasingly using DBT approaches to help all clients ride the emotional roller coaster of life. Its effective research supports it. It's accessible, it can be taught in group settings, and it's practical. It offers tangible tools, says Alec Miller, psychologist PhysD, author of DBT Skills Training with Adolescents, and co-director of Cognitive and Behavioral Consultants in New York City. As for the exceedingly complex name, Molly Hunt, Ph.D., co-director of Santa Monica Psychology Group in Los Angeles, explains that dialectical thinking is the ability to hold two seemingly contradictory truths in your mind at once. The ability to see things not as good or bad, but good and bad. Here's why that's important. When we get less polarized in our own heads, we do less extreme thinking and feel less extreme emotions, Miller explains. At the heart of DBT is one core dialectic. You have to accept yourself the way you are. And at the same time, you have to work toward change. The top five tactics. 1. Get to know your wise mind. We have three different emotional states of being, explains Hunt. There's emotion mind, a hot, urgent, impulsive state. That's reasonable mind, the perspective of how things should be, fully devoid of emotion. And then there's wise mind, which is a synthesis of the two, taking into account how you feel and also what's practical. They're sort of like the id, ego, and superego, just a little less Freud-y. When making a decision, first figure out what state of mind you're in. Then ask yourself what each of these three minds wants you to do. Mapping it all out helps you find a way forward. Spoiler alert, wise mind is the one to listen to. So if, for example, someone you've been dating suddenly drops out of touch, your emotion mind might want you to text him a string of expletives. Reasonable mind might want you to realize he lives far away, so it probably wouldn't have worked out anyway. Wise mind might want you to let him know you've been thinking of him and would love to get together again. 2. Ask yourself, what is the one thing I'm doing right now? As someone who's allergic to meditation, I was relieved when Hunt offered this lotus position free mindfulness technique. Let's say you're making dinner and watching TV and worrying about how your son just failed his math test and feeling really overwhelmed. Stop and ask yourself, what's the one thing I'm doing right now? Okay, I'm chopping this onion, Hunt explains. Then refocus your 5 senses on that task. Smell the onion. Go ahead and taste it too. Mindfulness accomplished. 3. Cool down, quite literally. The key to resisting impulsive behavior when you're really upset, says Hunt, is to do whatever you can to get through the next 5 minutes and not make things worse. In the DBT biz, this is called distress tolerance, and one go-to is to drop your temperature, literally, in the heat of the moment. Hold an ice cube in your hands, splash cold water on your face, or press an ice pack to your wrist. It helps to slow down your nervous system, says Hunt, and prevents you from doing something you'll later regret. 4. Name it to tame it. Emotions always show up as waves, and there are always periods in between the waves when we can catch our breath, McKay says. It's about learning to surf the wave. Right. Sure, dude. Cowabunga. It's just how... Let's build on the metaphor. When we're upset, McKay says, we tend to do 3 things that get us dragged under the wave and pummeled. 1, we try to resist the emotion. 2, we ruminate or think about what happened on repeat play. 3, we do emotion-driven behaviors that make everything so much worse. Instead, observe your emotion, non-judgmentally, and then label it. Maybe it's, I'm so hurt I want to curl up in a ball, or anger is bubbling up inside of me. As soon as you name the feeling, it starts to slowly dissipate. 5, spread the goodness to your relationships. All 3 experts say that the best way to make people feel understood while helping them regulate emotions is through validation. This includes common sense hallmarks like active listening through eye contact, but there's a secret sauce too. Let the other person know that their experience makes sense to you in the current context, explains Miller. Just offering, I totally get what you feel, that get why you feel that way, anyone in your situation would feel the same, normalizes the other person's emotional response, which helps it subside. And hey, don't forget to validate yourself too. Okay, we're moving over to the TVs and movie section. Jada Pinkett Smith's show Red Table Talk has been canceled. Facebook Watch original programming is shutting down, but is this really the end for Emmy-winning show? On Wednesday evening, Red Table Talk, the Emmy Award-winning talk show hosted by Jada Pinkett Smith, her daughter Willow Smith, and her mother Adrienne Banfield Norris, was canceled by Meta. This announcement comes on the heels of the departure of Minna LeFevre, the former head of development and programming at Meta. LeFevre exited the company as a part of the most recent round of layoffs this month, and with her go the last of the Facebook Watch original programs. Red Table Talk features 3 generations of the famous family and is known for its candid, open conversations with a dash of drama. We all remember the iconic entanglement moment, don't we? This May will mark 5 years since the beginning of the talk show, and its most recent, but perhaps not final, episode aired December 19, 2022. Deadline, which first reported the news, also relays that the producer, Westbrook Studios, is currently looking for a new distributor. In a statement released on Instagram, Pinkett Smith expressed her gratitude and hopes of continuing the show. We are so grateful to have had such a beautiful friendship with Facebook Watch, and we're sorry to see the entire team disband, she writes. We wish everyone well in their new journeys to come. We at Red Table are in talks of finding a new home, and we'll see you soon. Continuing on in TV and movies, Oprah wishes Carol Burnett a happy 90th birthday. Getting to turn 90 in great health. What a powerful testimony for living strong, living well, living with laughter, Oprah said. Carol Burnett is an icon whose comedy and charisma has touched millions of people, including Oprah, who is wishing Burnett a happy 90th birthday. Last night on Burnett's birthday, NBC aired a special event, Carol Burnett, 90 Years of Laughter, Plus Love. In celebration of her life and career, now available to stream on Peacock, the special featured a slew of celebrity guests who came together to pay tribute to Burnett. It was an event filled with exactly what the title suggests. Laughs, music, and a whole lot of love. I feel like I'm 11, Burnett told Page Six in an interview about the special. I was absolutely gobsmacked by the evening. It was incredible. It's not a birthday party. It's not a roast. It's a variety show. Musical stars like Bernadette Peters, Billy Porter, Kristen Chenoweth, Jane Lynch, and Katy Perry gave live performances. Performers who saw Burnett as a role model, Kristen Wiig, Allison Janney, and Laura Dern, to name a few, paid tribute, too. It was fantastic, Burnett told NBC in an interview. As I have said before, I didn't want a birthday party with a cake and balloons and confetti. I wanted it to be kind of an old-time variety show with live entertainment. We had a 90-piece orchestra. We had funny clips and wonderful guests who came on and were funny. Burnett's longtime friend Julie Andrews was there, as well as comedians and actors like Bill Hader, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph, Steve Carell, Taraji P. Henson, Cheryl LaRouf, Lee Ralph, and many more. Oprah joined via video, along with other celebrities like Dolly Parton, Steve Martin, Martin Short, Jimmy Fallon, and Michelle Obama. Carol, getting to turn 90 in great health. What a powerful testimony for living strong, living well, living with laughter, Oprah said. Thank you for all the joy you've brought to all of us these years. God bless. Happy birthday. You can watch her video or stream the entire birthday celebration on Peacock. Moving into the beauty section on hair. I didn't fight my gray hair. I embraced it. Sometimes your defining feature chooses you. Rory Evans assesses her roots. What's at the root of our hair choices? Three writers unravel the state of their strands. Read the stories below. Earlier this month, I bought a nice and easy hair color kit. It's been sitting on my entryway console ever since as I mull over whether I should actually break down and use it. I say break down because I've been going gray for 25 years now and haven't dyed it yet. In my late 20s, when the grays started coming in, I didn't explicitly decide to not fight them. It's more like the decision was made for me, because at the time I was an early adopter of the Japanese magic perm straightening treatment, which predated the widespread availability of the Brazilian blowout, and they really didn't know if the straightening would make color-processed hair fall out. It certainly made my grays less wiry and almost gave them a shiny sparkle. Since I valued straight hair over brunette hair, I went with the straight. In my mid-30s, I got together with my now husband, who importantly has always loved my gray hair. In fact, he says that of all the things I've gone in for over the years, Botox, permanent eyeliner, laser hair removal, all the set-it-and-forget-it treatments, dyeing my hair would be grounds for divorce. If I did find myself single in my 50s, I would hightail my rear end to a colorist. When people ask me why I let myself go gray, and boy, did they ask. I always explain that I caught my fish and my fish likes my gray hair. My fish also had the good sense to rapidly go gray himself in the past 5 years with a full-on Dumbledore situation in his beard. Another gray-friendly formative event occurred in my mid-30s. My mom, who'd been dyeing her hair for as long as I could remember, decided to let her sparkling white hair take over. That growing out phase was ugly and awkward. Watching her gingery, light brown, short hair slowly grow out to become a Mary Berry-style platinum white was months in the growing and waiting. One morning, my dad carried on a full conversation with what he thought was my mom, still in bed, before realizing he was in fact talking to the mottled marmalade cat nestled on her pillow. Seeing my mom's hair transition just as my own gray started regenerating with rapid speed, I remember thinking, I don't ever want to weather a growing out phase like that. I don't want to have a big old stripe of Anderson Cooper roots along my part as my hair grows out. If I occasionally, increasingly feel like my gray hair is at odds with how I imagine my brunette self, it does jibe with my inherent practicality and thrift. I simply do not feel like I have to spare time or money for salon dyeing. I used to share an office with a woman who would disappear for a full afternoon every month to get her hair colored. I was always gripped with the certainty that I would be fired if I ever tried such thing, and broke if I had to pay several $100 for the color. The one person who would be really good at home coloring my hair is my husband. As a professional cabinet maker, he regularly mixes and titrates wood finishes and stains, but, as established, he is not interested in helping me. Of course, I realize how lucky I am that my decades of going gray has more or less coincided with young women actually choosing to dye their hair gray, and a resultant proliferation of really good brass-cutting shampoos and conditioners. My hair has come of age just as some foundational ideas of beauty and aging have changed, and I'm grateful for that too. But also, I get so very many compliments on my gray hair the way I never did when it was brown. Maybe it's dog whistle stuff and the subtext is, "You are so brave for becoming an old bag with such dignity," or whatever other nonsense they mean. But on the face of it, they're saying something nice, and I say, "Thank you," and go on with my day. It gives me just enough confidence to walk past the nice and easy in my entryway for a few more days, at least. Portions of this article were edited. We're going over to the books section. This article is How My Own Wedding Vows Showed Me My Marriage Was Crumbling. Laura Cathcart Robbins, author of Stash, is forced to confront her past and the facade she created in order to succeed in her career and relationships. As I'm walking in the house, I hear the family room TV blasting. I drop my keys in the bowl by the door and quickly round the corner into the long hallway that leads to the west side of the house. I call Jordan's name, but he can't hear me over the TV. I can see him and Jacob lying on the big sofa, arms and legs akimbo, chewing on the collars of their respective school shirts with their eyes fixed on the screen in front of them. I open my mouth to call his name again, then stop in my tracks. Oh my God, it's the wedding scene. They're watching Skirmish. I think about you all day long when I'm not near you. All I think about is being near you, and when you are near me, I feel like I'm finally at peace with the world. Nearly 3 years ago, my husband was directing what was sure to be the biggest blockbuster of the summer, starring the hottest male comedian to hit the silver screen in decades. Right in the middle of filming, he came home late one night to tell me they'd been stuck on a scene. The scene where the title character, Skirmish, recites his vows to the woman he loves. "I love the wedding vows you wrote," my husband said. "Would you mind if I use them for the scene? We need him to floor her, floor the audience. Nothing the writers are coming up with is close. Maybe it's because I keep comparing whatever they write to yours. Will you?" I was flattered, honored. But more than that, I was confused. I felt like we'd been tiptoeing around each other for months, or at least since he'd started shooting 16 weeks earlier. There had been lots of fumbling kisses at the door and quick platonic calls from the set, mainly about the kids, waking up to find his side of the bed empty after a night shoot. I decided that the absence of adult conversation from our day-to-day was my fault. So on shoot days, I started writing out cheat sheets of interesting things to discuss with him when he'd call or come home. The Pussycat Dolls and Snoop Dogg winning Best Video, The Patriot Act, maybe you can explain it to me? Israel's PM suffering a stroke, not sure what this means for the Middle East? Of course, I said, that would be amazing. All at once, I was inundated with equal parts guilt and hope. Guilt because parts of me had already given up on my marriage and had been kind of relieved. Hope because perhaps his asking me meant something. He could have asked anyone in Hollywood to write this for him, and he asked me, and maybe he's read my thoughts, and this was his way of saying, "Don't give up on us yet." "Mommy?" Jacob spots me and lights up, holding his arms out in my direction. "Come here and watch Skirmish with us. Daddy got us the new director's cut." Even though I'm starting to disassociate, I can still vaguely feel their warm arms and curly heads curving around my shoulders and chest as I sit down between them. "Watch, Mommy." The comedian is in his fat suit, reading his vows to his thin, beautiful bride. But all I see is me in my princess dress on the cliff overlooking the valley at sunset. I can picture our hands clasped together and me looking into my husband's eyes, waiting to say the words. Words I'd worked on for weeks, crossing out and rewriting, adding, reciting to Shelley over drinks, saying out loud in the mirror. Words I kept on a folded piece of paper in the breast of my Vera Wang corset top until Rabbi Wiseman turned to me and nodded. "The only thing I really want to do is spend the rest of my life making you as happy as you've made me." "Hey," I say abruptly, starting to stand up, "I'll be right back, okay?" "No," yelled Jordan. "The best part's coming, Mom. Just wait." I can feel the pressure behind my eyes, like a garden hose that's being stepped on while the water runs. And any second now it's going to blow. Who did he marry that day? Some con woman? An imposter who duped him into believing her hustle? I know that I'll never have to ask God for anything, because with you in my life I have everything I ever wanted. Tears are streaming down my face now. No. This wasn't any hustle. I meant every word. Our wedding day was the happiest day of my life, not because of the whole Vera Wang martini bar bride fairy tale weddingness of it all, because that's not really my gig, but because I was marrying him. I loved him so much. "Hey, guys. Mom, just stay, please." It was me I didn't love, at least not enough. I didn't trust that he'd still love me if I came clean about who I was. So the relationship was doomed from the start, wasn't it? The day I said those words to him, I buried the real Laura, having no idea about the price I would pay for that act. I sniff and wipe my eyes with the back of my hand. Jacob looks up sharply then. "Why are you crying, Mom?" Jordan laughs out loud. "Mom, you cry at everything. You can't cry at skirmish." They're both laughing now. I force a smile through my tears. "Yeah. Silly Mama," I say. Staying in books, we have 5 books every mother will enjoy. Celebrate the mothers, mother-in-law, grandmothers, godmothers, and all the other mother figures in your life with a book that honors their gifts. What do you buy for the mom who is a multitasker and has very little downtime? Gift her with a book that will capture her attention and afford a much-needed break from her routine. These 5 books are varied and include a cookbook with recipes from Tigray and Australia, a novel as engrossing as it is poignant, and a memoir from a mother on the bittersweetness of children growing up fast. There's something for every mom in your life. Celebrate them today and every day of the year. Number 1. It Goes So Fast by Mary Louise Kelly. From All Things Considered, co-host Mary Louise Kelly comes an action-packed and intimate memoir written during her eldest son's final year before he left for college. Kelly writes candidly about the bittersweetness of watching one's children become independent adults. As she puts it, our children are outgrowing us from the moment they are born, and about how she balanced the responsibilities of being a mother with having a high-stakes, very public career. It Goes So Fast is about both the soccer games Kelly went to and the ones that she missed, the moments when motherhood means being present and protective and nurturing, and the moment when it means letting go. Number 2. The Last Animal by Ramona Azubel. This whip-smart and compulsively readable novel begins in Siberia, where a recently widowed paleobiologist, Jane, has lugged her two teenage daughters on a research trip. A startling discovery sets off a series of events that land the grieving trio into a castle in Italy, trying to implant a woolly mammoth embryo into the womb of an eccentric couple's pet elephant. Surprising, funny, and poignant, The Last Animal is both a wildly entertaining adventure story and a meditation on what it means to love your children, fiercely and imperfectly, in the age of extinction, a time when their future appears more tenuous than ever. Number 3. My Picture Diary by Fujiwara Maki, translated by Ryan Holmberg. Her name is spelled Fujiwara, last name is Maki. In 1981, Fujiwara Maki decided to keep a picture diary to preserve memories of her son's early childhood. Because 8mm film was expensive, each entry consists of a hand-drawn scene from the day, along with a brief note about what transpired. Maki's illustrations are full of charm and pathos. Her Her notes, in turn, funny, tragic, and arresting. Daily life typically just passes by in a haze, she writes in the afterword. But strangely, once I started drawing this picture diary, events of significance to us as a family began to accumulate. Number 4. Tekebosh and Saba by Saba Ali Mayo. Tekebosh is spelled T-A-K-E-B-A-S-H and Saba is S-A-B-A. So it's by Saba, S-A-B-A, and her last name is A-L-E-M-A-Y-O-H. Tekebosh and Saba is not only a beautiful cookbook with stunning photos of food, art, people, and landscapes, but also a story of migration, culture, and family, told by the daughter of an Ethiopian refugee. Alemayo's mother, Tekebosh, fled from Tigray, a region of northern Ethiopia, to Sudan, and again from Sudan to Melbourne, where the two opened a successful Ethiopian restaurant in 2015. Recipes range from staples of Tigrayan cuisine, like Kayi Sebahai, which is spelled K-E-Y-I-H-S-E-B-H-I, a celebratory red goat stew, or Hamli, H-A-M-L-I, a garlicky sautéed greens dish, to recipes that reflect the family's current home, such as Tekebosh's barbecue rub, which combines Australian traditions. There is nothing more Australian than barbecuing, Saba jokes, with classic Tigrayan ingredients like Victoria bitter lager and dillik, D-I-L-I-K. Number 5. Seasonal Family Almanac by Emma Frisch and Jana Blankenship. Looking for nature-based activities to do with the entire family? Each of the 12 chapters of this guide offers a selection of crafts and recipes tied to a specific time of year. Think a calendula and a coconut castile shampoo recipe for early spring, an into the dark lantern crafting activity for late fall, and homemade chamomile eye pillows for a midwinter bedtime ritual. Full of inspiration and delights, especially for younger children, kids, and parents who want to have fun but have just run out of ideas. Okay, moving on to intentions, 11 tiny ways to inject hope into your day. It's all around us, we just have to recognize it. Hope doesn't mean you're ignoring all the horrible things out there in the world. Hope means you're finding a way to keep functioning in your life, which might even make you better equipped to help make things ever so slightly better. The next time you begin to spiral down, try one of these perspective-changing strategies. Reread your favorite uplifting novel from when you were a kid. I'm telling you, there are few moods a couple of hours with Anne of Green Gables or something like that can't soothe. The sincerity, the earnestness, the simplicity, the belief that all problems are fixable with the right attitude. Remember how Anne wins over countless curmudgeonly adults with her optimism? No matter what kind of book you're reading, things are generally solved by the end of it. That's how plots work, after all. It's a good reminder that things do eventually get better. Review your circles. My friends and family are sick to death of hearing me say, circle of control, circle of concern. But whenever I'm overwhelmed by the world, it works. Popularized by Stephen Covey, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People guy, the concept behind the circles has been in existence since the Stoic philosophers of ancient Greece. The idea is to think about what concerns you, which is probably, if you're a sentient human, a lot of big stuff. From war overseas to the melting ice caps. Inside of that circle is the circle of influence, or the stuff you can maybe kind of do something about. The local school board elections, say. The rummage sale at your church. And then, inside of that, is the circle of control. This is the stuff you actually are in charge of. How you live your life, how you treat the people around you, how you show up at work, at school, in your family, with your friends. This is the only stuff you really, really have control over. So if you're feeling despair about something ginormous, then you can't really change. Remind yourself that your feelings are valid. But that isn't in an area to obsess over. What do you actually have control over? Focus there. Talk to a kid about their favorite animal facts. Seriously, for some mysterious reason, elementary age children seem to have countless amazing bits of animal trivia at their fingertips. Did you know that the oldest cat ever was named Cream Puff and lived to be 38? Well, my 5th grader did. It's not that it's the next generation's job to cheer us up about the world, yikes, but it's a relief to remember that every once in a while, the kids are all right. Update your phone's operating system. I know that sounds boring, but it's also fun to have new emojis and increased capabilities. And in iOS 16, you can unsend texts. Great news for those terribly awkward moments when you realize you sent your parent something you meant to send your partner. Look, we're all making mistakes and correcting them and getting better all the time. It's true of operating systems, and it's true of us clumsy humans, too. Take a nap. Yes, it's advice your mother would give you, but you know what? Mothers know what they're talking about. Everything seems more dire when you're worn out. Here are some of my personal rules for a perfect nap. First, drink coffee. I know, just trust me, it's a thing. Then, open window shades and curtains. As cats and dogs know, sunbeams make for quality naps. Play some relaxing music. Get on top of your covers with a special napping blanket. Under-the-cover naps are only for the feverish. And nap for 20 minutes. I'm willing to bet you'll wake up better able to put things in perspective. Microdose a little awe. Moonwalk through the awe-inspiring images from the James Webb Telescope that is something bigger out there. Call or write to your representatives, local or national, and urge them to fight for the environment. I know this is one of those huge things that seems unsolvable and hopeless, but it's literally not. The UN has found that the world's air pollution could be rapidly cleaned up if enough governments adopted the WHO's air quality guidelines. That's good to hear, right? It's really not too late. It almost never is. And take some small step toward action can really aerate your mood. Pile on topping. Just as it did in the 90s, Froyo still works. My son was having a dreary day full of mundane disappointments when he asked if frozen yogurt was a real thing, or just a joke they made online. We made a beeline for one of those places where they have way too many flavors of soft-serve frozen yogurt, and I let the kids pile their blobs with chocolate chunks, marshmallows, peanut butter cups, sprinkles, coconut shavings, butterscotch chips, and other tooth-curdling confections. The frozen yogurt still tastes like mostly nothing, but with a pile of crazy toppings, it's a masterpiece, just like life. Ask a friend to text you a picture of something that's making them happy these days. People love to have an excuse to share their kids' new lover, houseplant, win, exercise routine, bearded dragon, and it's legitimately cheering to hear this sort of thing. Take it from me, someone who just got text a photo essay about the dumbest but cutest household chickens in all of Iowa. Parts of this article were edited. Reading in Oprah's Daily Insiders, Oprah and Gail encourage you to do something you've always wanted to do. Hi, everybody. Oprah, happy Sunday. I have to tell you that at the beginning of this year, Gail said to me, Gail, it's not just going to be 2020, it's going to be 2020 me. Oprah and I said, what does that mean? Gail said, I said it's going to be the year that I do things that I want to do personally and professionally, whatever that is. I was interviewing Michael B. Jordan recently. He said 2023 is his year because he feels he's firing on all cylinders. 23 was also Michael Jordan's jersey number, as you know. So he said 2023 is his year, and when he said that, I said, Michael, I feel that too. Step outside your box and do things you haven't thought about before, personally and professionally. That's what I'm going to do. Oprah, so that's why you hear prayers in the background. There are prayers 4 times a day here. Gail, speaking of something we've never done. Oprah, speaking of something we've ever done before, we're in Aqaba. Jordan, it is the city that Time says you must visit in 2023. It's on a list of 100 cities, and so we're saying yes to Jordan all this week. We started at the Dead Sea. We went to the baptismal site where Jesus was baptized by John in the Jordan River. Gail, and we took some of the water. Oprah, yes, we took some of the water, and then we went to Petra. If you've never been there, I'm telling you, it is a must go see. Shockingly, astonishingly beautiful. Gail, I've never seen anything like it. Oprah, yesterday we were in Wadi Rum, and today we're in Aqaba. We're stepping out of our box and going on adventures because it's 2020 me, not just 2023. Gail, we encourage you to do that too. Oprah, what is something you've always wanted to do? I've always wanted to see Petra. What is something you've always wanted to do, and now you've been inspired to do it? Go well. We're now in Oprah's My Favorite Things. Give you some ideas of things you might want to purchase. in the cozy section, Softie's Heathered Marshmallow Lounger. It's $119 on Amazon. When Gail saw this, she immediately said, I'm definitely getting this, the gray one and the blue one. I live in Softies, and this ultra-soft lounger, it's called marshmallow fabric for a reason, works as well for running errands with some boots as it does for a cozy night with a pair of snuggly socks. In wellness gifts, we have the Santa Barbara Design Studio Foot Care Kit. It's $21 at Amazon. Know someone who spends their days on their feet or who is about to walk into the next phase of their life? Give them this classy foot care set, a foot scrubber to tackle rough soles, and a foot roller to massage sore areas. In the home section, there are Cozy Earth Waffle Bath Bundle. You can buy them on Amazon. I take bathing very seriously, and having a great towel to wrap yourself in afterwards is key. This set comes with a waffle texture on one side that looks good hanging in your bathroom, while the other side is terry cloth that's soft and absorbent. Does not have a price listed on that. In the food section, the Cravery Bestsellers Mix. It's $40 at Amazon. Not just your average chocolate chip cookies, though they have those too. This San Diego-based business offers fun flavors like birthday cake, red velvet, and lemon bar. This 18-cookie pack comes with a mix of its bestsellers, which are baked to order and so soft in ensuring that the lucky recipient gets the freshest possible treats. And next to it is the Pepper Creek Farms Hot Chocolate Gift Crate. It's $40 at Amazon. 'Tis the season to curl up with a steaming mug of hot cocoa. This family fun business offers a variety pack of options that make it even more fun to whip up a cup. The hardest part? Figuring out what flavor you'll try first. The toasted marshmallow and salted caramel are especially yummy. In the stylish section, we have a Paravel fold-up backpack. It's $75 at Amazon. It's made from 15 upcycled plastic water bottles fashioned into lightweight, water-resistant nylon. Its party trick is that it can fold up into a zippable pouch and you can stow it away in your luggage so you have an extra bag. For kids, we have the Nori, N-O-R-I, Press Steam Iron. It's $120 at Amazon. This gadget quickly presses both sides of a shirt, dress, or pair of pants and reaches its highest temperatures in 3 minutes. You can also use it to steam or refresh clothes, and with people traveling again, it's ideal to throw into your suitcase. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.